Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You're listening to The Murder in My Family, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including Missing Persons,
DNA ID,
Scene of the Crime,
Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
Citizen Detective,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
The views and opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the podcast, its host, or sponsors.
If you would like to discuss the murder in your family on this podcast, please be sure to visit themurderinmyfamily.com for more information.
You can support this podcast by visiting patreon.com/themurderinmyfamily. This episode may contain unsettling material or subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Murder in My Family. I'm your host, Mike Morford. In this episode, we'll be discussing the case of a woman who was attacked and stabbed to death in a big city while walking home after a late-night shift from her job. Although it seems that she may have been the victim of a botched mugging, the fact she wasn't robbed and had all of her belongings seems to point to a different motive. When police started looking into her life, they found other avenues worth exploring. Was this attack personal? Or was she the victim of random violence? We'll dive into this case after some quick housekeeping. Independent podcasts like this one depend on word of mouth to bring in new listeners. So if you find that you enjoy this show, please take a moment to rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcast. And be sure to introduce a friend to the show and invite them to listen. With your help, The Murder of My Family can continue to grow and reach a new audience. To learn more about the show or the cases we discuss, please visit themurdermyfamily.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @murdermyfam or on Facebook at facebook.com/TMIMFpodcast. If you'd like to support this show through a Patreon donation, it's always appreciated, and you can do so by visiting patreon.com/themurdermyfamily. Benefits of supporting the show on Patreon may include early access to ad-free episodes of the show, plus bonus content not heard in regular episodes. Support may also include thank you cards, stickers, and more. In each episode, I'll give shout-outs to any new supporters. And thank you to all of the supporters that generously donate to help keep the show growing and improving. One last note. Please support any of the sponsors that you hear on The Murder of My Family the way that those sponsors support the show. It's with our sponsor support that this show can go on and continue to provide a platform to share these stories with you in every episode. Thank you. And now on with the show. Ernestine Morgan was born July 19, 1933 in Smithville, Arkansas, to parents Francis and Viola Morgan. Not much is known about her younger years, but eventually Ernestine met and wound up marrying Thomas Hurt, and they moved to Ohio. By 1955, the couple welcomed their first child, a daughter, Sharon. They would go on to have two more children, sons Larry and Gary. The family settled into the Price Hill section of Cincinnati. Ernestine worked for Universal Building Services doing cleaning work, and since March 1981 when she joined the company, she was tasked with overseeing cleaning services done at the Procter & Gamble Company's headquarters on 6th and Sycamore in Cincinnati. This was Ernestine's first job outside of the family's Price Hill neighborhood. Her daughter Sharon also worked for the same company. By June 1982, Ernestine had been promoted to a supervisor's position. She was assigned her own work crew on the night shift. Ernestine was excited about the promotion, but also a little bit nervous about the work schedule because she'd be getting off late at night. The options she had to catch the bus were 11:51 p.m. and 12:30 a.m. Most nights, her husband Tom or her daughter Sharon would walk with her, but not every night. And on one of those nights, Thursday, June 24th, 1982, just after midnight, the unthinkable happened. Ernestine was attacked and stabbed outside of a White Castle restaurant she frequented. She screamed out for help and was aided by nearby workers on a painting crew who heard her calls. By the time they got there, her attacker had fled. She was rushed to the hospital but died the next day, leaving her family devastated. To police, this seemed like it could have been a mugging gone wrong. After all, it was after midnight in a big city, and Ernestine was walking alone. But her purse and other items were not taken. It seemed as if the attack on Ernestine was something personal. Perhaps she was targeted. Police went back and looked at Ernestine's timeline and movements the night of the attack. Ernestine got off work at 11:30 and stopped at the White Castle she frequented for coffee with her supervisor while she waited to catch the 12:30 bus. According to Ernestine's husband, Tom, the supervisor never showed up to White Castle, so after waiting about 20 minutes, Ernestine headed out towards the bus stop to catch her bus. It was on her way there that she was attacked. At 12:05 a.m., the painting crew working at the Procter & Gamble Company headquarters heard a woman scream for help twice. They ran to her, and they saw her staggering down 6th Street. Purse, office keys, and a flashlight she carried were all on the ground, and there was no sign of anyone else nearby. Police did locate one woman who saw the attack, but it happened quickly, and the details she provided were not great. According to the witness, she was standing on 6th and Main at the corner when she saw a man jump out of a recessed doorway of the nearby Buskin Bakery on 6th Street. He stabbed Ernestine and then ran off into the night. The witness said he had a medium build. One news source reported that the suspect was a black male, but it's unclear if that's accurate. Police never cleared that up or provided many details in the case. But it turns out there was a burglar at a clothing store in Vine Street during the same time frame when Ernestine was attacked. In that incident, a light-skinned black male stabbed two female employees who were opening the store and took off with their keys. The owner of the store saw the man running away as he was arriving for the workday. He tackled the man, but the attacker was able to get away and fled the scene. A news article says that Ernestine was attacked and robbed by a man with a similar description as the man in the other incident, and police thought it was possible the two cases were connected, but no firm link was ever found. Police also found out that Ernestine was involved in a disturbing incident that happened before she died. She had been verbally attacked by a man near the White Castle she often visited at 6th and Main Street. Witnesses in this incident said the man had waved his hands in her face and she told him she didn't like it. He got mad and followed her across the street and into the White Castle. Then he stood over her saying something to the effect of, "I'll mess you up good." Although the man in this first incident wasn't identified, at least publicly, he's said to have matched the description of a man that Ernestine worked with. A man that was said to have been angry that she got the promotion to supervisor and he felt passed over. Reportedly, police ruled this co-worker out in some capacity of being involved in Ernestine's murder, but exactly how that was done or how solid his alibi was remains unclear. But an angry co-worker wasn't the only possible angle that came up in this case. My guest in today's episode, Mariah, who is Ernestine's granddaughter, told me that there was a rumor that Ernestine was having an affair with a colleague. Although there aren't many details about this possible affair, it does provide a situation that could lead to violence. Perhaps if Ernestine was involved in one, she ended it and the other person wasn't happy. Of course, an affair could lead to a jealous spouse, and that could make Ernestine's husband Tom look like a suspect. But it doesn't seem like police really considered Tom a suspect at all. And Mariah told me that knowing him as well as she did, there was absolutely no way in her mind that he would have ever killed Ernestine. There was another possible motive that needed to be explored. Mariah believed that one of her relatives was a small-time drug dealer and a confidential police informant for the Cincinnati Police Department. Is it possible that some criminal linked to him killed Ernestine in order to send a message to one of her relatives not to snitch to police? It's possible, but there's nothing solid to prove that's the case. And in the end, there's really nothing to point in any direction in this case. Authorities have confirmed publicly there's no physical evidence that they can test in the case. And sadly, Ernestine's husband Thomas and her three children, Sharon, Larry, and Gary, have all passed away with no answers about what happened to her. If you happen to have any information about the murder of Ernestine Hurt, please call the Cincinnati Police Department at 513-263-8300. Ernestine's granddaughter, Mariah, has been advocating for her grandmother's case and making sure it simply isn't forgotten. She joined me to discuss her grandmother and her tragic death and about her quest to find out who was responsible. That conversation is coming up in just a moment.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I'm Ryan. Thank you for coming on to discuss your grandmother's case with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad that we were finally able to connect to do this.
Yeah. And this is, I know your family has been searching for justice here for quite a while. This is a case that's, you know, over 40 years old. Before we get into the details of what happened to your grandmother, can you tell us a little bit about her herself and what you remember of her and what she was like?
With me being as young as I was at the time, I don't remember a whole lot, but I do remember that she was a very loving, very caring person. She was always involved in my upbringing and everything. And pretty much from the time that I was a baby until she passed away, well, was taken away from us. We lived in my grandfather's home. So we were always together and always around each other. So it was really odd not having her around anymore. But she was a great person. She loved gardening. She loved cooking. She loved being around family and interacting with everybody. And, you know, I honestly don't know of anyone who had anything bad to say about her. I mean, to be fair, I mean, she, as far as I could tell, she was a great person.
And how old were you when she was killed?
It was, I want to say 82. I always get it confused, 82 or 84. But if it was 82, I would have been seven, 10 years old. No, I'm sorry, 10 years old. I was 10.
Okay. Yeah, so it's got to be a real tough situation to lose a grandparent in such a terrible way at that time for you.
Yeah. And the more I think about it, I think I was actually 7 when it happened. And then we moved from there to another area of town when I was around 10. That's what it was.
Okay. Now, your grandmother lived in a place called Price Hill, which was a suburb or a community in Cincinnati, basically. Is that correct?
Yes. Price Hill, at that time, and I apologize for my voice. I'm just getting over a cold too. My grandmother, what was it? Price Hill. Yeah. Price Hill. It was kind of like an up and coming area. It was still kind of like getting to its peak and everything. Pretty much everybody knew everybody. We were all really protective of each other. I was able to, when I was a kid, I was able to sleep out on the porch with the, you know, without having to worry about getting snatched or, you know, anything bad happening or anything. We used to sleep in the house with the windows unlocked or the doors open, and there was never a problem, you know, so it was a nice neighborhood.
And obviously, you know, this is on the outskirts of Cincinnati or part of Cincinnati. You get into big cities that you typically do expect to have more crimes. You have a bigger population, so it's only likely there's going to be more crime. But in the time that your grandparents lived there, and I don't know how long they did live there, but did they ever have any problems, any run-ins or anything, any other instances of crime up before that?
The only things that I know of right offhand would have been there were individuals in our family that, or at least one individual in our family that was dealing marijuana at the time, and it wasn't something that was actually, you know, legalized or looked at, you know, it wasn't something that was held in high regard. That individual, my uncle, he was giving information to the ex, well, at the time he was a beat cop. He ended up making lieutenant and eventually ended up becoming chief of police. You know, I've tried talking to him. He's been, you know, contacted for information and stuff. But to get back to the crime stuff, the only thing I can think of is my uncle doing that and providing information to the police.
Okay. And I had read that there was some possibility he was an informant and something. We'll get into that as we move along. But I want to go back to when this happened. It was June 24th, 1982. Obviously, yeah. You were a child, so I'm sure they didn't talk about a lot of these details as it happened with you. But as you learned older, as you got older, maybe you found out some of these details or read newspapers, things like that. Can you walk us through how things unfolded that day as far as you understand them?
It's my understanding that honestly, the night before or like a week before, something like that, my grandmother ended up getting a promotion to supervisor, and one of the coworkers that she had previously had gotten upset about it and wanted the job for themselves. And the person had wanted the job for themselves and got upset about it. I was told that they had an altercation by the White Castle in downtown Cincinnati the night before she was murdered. The day that it happened, there was apparently only one witness who either was afraid to give an actual description or didn't see the assailant to be able to give a description. But it was the one and only time that my grandmother was by herself when she was going to and from work that day. My mother had taken off for some reason, and I don't remember what it was. And then my grandfather wasn't able to meet her at the bus stop like he would normally, because he had something he had to take care of too. And I found out at a later time that she was stabbed twice, but I had been told she had been stabbed multiple times, not just twice. All I know as far as the actual crime itself, nothing was taken. Because no money was taken, no purse was taken, jacket wasn't taken. Everything that she had with her that she would normally carry was all still around her or on her. They believed, at least I was told, that they thought that it was a personal crime. You know, somebody was upset with her and taking it out on her.
Hmm. Yeah, that would, you know, that would seem to rule out a mugging or something. If somebody, if it was right. Mugging gone wrong or something like that, you think they would have taken her purse or whatever valuables they can. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned there was one witness. How quickly did police or EMTs arrive? Was it pretty quickly or did it take a while? Do you know?
I honestly am not 100% sure, but I do know that there were two construction workers around the corner from where she was at. So when she screamed for help, they did come running over and everything and found her. I don't know how long it took them to get there, but I do know that she didn't pass away until the next day. So she was in a lot of pain when she went in that process. And I think that's the worst part of it for me is knowing that she wasn't able to go peacefully.
Yeah. She suffered and it was painful. I'm curious, was she like alert and awake? Was she able to tell police anything at all or not?
I honestly don't know. I was never told any of that information by any of my family that was present. I know that my grandfather, my mother, my uncles, my great aunt, everybody had gone to the hospital to visit with her and stuff. And I was not allowed to go. So I am not 100% sure.
And you mentioned that the next day she passed away. That's got to be awful for your entire family, but especially you as a young child and stuff. How did you all process that information that she had passed away?
Not well. That night that it happened and they ended up going to the hospital and found out everything, I was sent to my other grandmother's house, which was right down the street. When I got there, there was a news clip that had come on, and my uncle used to torment the crap out of me when I was a child. And, you know, so when I saw this news story come onto the TV, I honestly thought that he, and in a child's mind, they can't really rationalize, but I really honestly thought that he was playing a huge prank and stuff just to mess with me some more. And, but this news story came on, said her name, and said that she had been stabbed and she had died. And I turned around and I looked at everybody in the room, and they were just like in shock, like totally horror, on their faces. And I couldn't understand like what was going on, but I knew something was wrong. And I literally stood up in the middle of the room and said, "Larry's playing a trick on me. This is a big joke and stuff." And I got really upset. Well, when my cousin took me back up to my other grandparent's house, back to where we lived at, I walked in the room and my best friend's mother was in there, and there were a lot of people in the room. I don't remember anyone other than my uncle Larry, my mother, my grandfather, and Sheila, my best friend's mother. I walked in, everybody's crying, their heads were all lowered and stuff, and I know they were all just dreading telling me. I knew that they were worried about it. So I walked in and Sheila had me sit on her lap, and you know, everybody was just sobbing. My mom, my grandfather, my uncles, they couldn't even speak. They were so choked up and stuff. And she was the one that told me my grandmother passed away. And I just screamed. I was so upset. I know that even to this day, with not having any kind of justice for what happened, you know, it really breaks my heart that there's a possibility that her only living sibling may not get any kind of resolution before she passes either. And that's one of my biggest reasons for pushing so hard to try to get any kind of resolution, is so that her sister would be able to get, you know, to know that justice was served, or at least who did it, or that they're not around to do it again.
Yeah. And these cases always have a ripple effect, because it always affects people in the family, you know, young children, they have to grow up without their parent, without their grandparent,
right?
You know, the family don't get answers and they pass away without ever finding out the truth. So there is a real, you know, trauma with that. I want to go back to the crucial person in this case that might have had the most information, was this one witness. Now, sometimes newspaper reports, or they don't report accurate stuff, or you know, they have to correct it later on. But one of the reports anyway, from back in that time, said that the witness reported seeing a black man run up, yes, and just stab her and then run off. Is that part accurate?
As far as I know, it was. I mean, just those few things would end up being descriptive of the coworker that they had that got upset with her getting supervisor and not him. So, I mean, with him being a black male, there is a very good possibility that it was actually him. But according to interviews and everything that the police had with him, they cleared him of any wrongdoing. So I don't know who he was. I don't know what his name was. But I do also know too that my grandmother was also supposedly having an affair with her supervisor. And so I don't know if maybe he got upset about that because of preferential treatment or something because of that. I don't know. But as far as the description goes, I mean, it's very possible.
Yeah. So it's you know, obviously, as someone that has a confrontation the day before, that would seem to go to the top of police radar, you know, hey, we got to look at this person. But hopefully they did, you know, verify and rule him out properly, that he was someplace else, that he had an alibi, because that does seem, the timing of that seems big. And, you know, the fact she wasn't robbed definitely seems like it was something personal. But then again, you brought up maybe she's having an affair. Obviously, that can cause, you know, a love triangle. Somebody's jealous. Somebody's upset over that. That opens up a whole new avenue.
Exactly. Well, and somebody had asked me previously if I thought by any stretch of the imagination if my grandfather could have even been capable of doing something like that. And I'm emphatically against that idea altogether. And not because of bias, but my grandfather has never been cruel or hateful to anyone. He had always been a gentleman, and he was always polite and friendly. Everybody loved him. He was a great guy. And he just didn't, from what I know about like the mind of people who think like that and stuff, like he just didn't fit the criteria from what I can understand. But I mean, it could have been her supervisor. I don't know. But I don't know. I'm just beside myself with the fact that the police weren't able to do more or push harder or anything like that, and how they could just so easily clear someone who, I mean, very obviously had a problem with her literally the night before and in front of that many people.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some things going on that seem to point to it, you know, being personal, going back to the fact nothing was stolen. Now, could she have been the targeted to be mugged and the person just panicked and ran off without taking anything? I mean, that could happen. But, you know, a purse seems, you know, if you're going to go through that trouble to attack someone and stab them, you're at least going to grab a purse and take off
before you think. And from also from my psychology classes and stuff too, because I've gone through a couple of different colleges where I had taken psychology courses and stuff, because I wanted to try to get my degree in understanding why a person's brain would work that way, or like what it is that makes a person think that it's a good idea to do something stupid like that. And in all those courses, if an assailant uses a knife and doesn't steal anything, it is always a personal issue. And the only time that it's not is if they're literally a psychopath. I don't know. But yeah, it definitely points to a personal issue.
Yeah. And then it also turns out that's the only night that there was nobody there with your grandmother.
Exactly.
So they knew her schedule were following or something like that. If it's not random.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I want to look at one other possibility you had mentioned, that this could have been some kind of revenge because your uncle was a pot dealer. You know, I they probably were grasping at straws for anything. If he's giving information to the police about something, maybe someone else, you know, took exception to that and they wanted to, you know, scare him by getting, you know, to your grandmother. How closely was that possibility looked into, do you know?
I honestly am not sure. I did ask my mom a couple times about that, and she never really went into a whole lot of detail. Now, my uncle, I know that he was mentally coherent, if that makes sense, but he was born what's called a blue baby. The umbilical cord was wrapped around his neck, and he did, you know, suffer some brain damage. So when his thought process wasn't always in the right place, and he would do some things that may not have been considered normal behavior to some people. Like he was using and dealing, but then he was providing information to the police throughout that entire time on people in his own neighborhood. And, you know, that's my theory, is that it was a retaliatory issue. But the more I've heard information and everything like that from the news stories that have been done and things that they've been able to dig up, and, you know, other information I've heard from family members and stuff, I think there's a really good chance that it's either going to have something to do with the affair that she was having, or it has to do with that employee that got upset.
Yeah, that's the vibe I get. It seems personal. Yeah. You know, and if this was some kind of retaliation against your uncle, you think they would take it out on your uncle himself, not his mom. But, you know, who knows, maybe they wanted to scare him and, you know, so that he'd never did that again. But it definitely seems personal. So I'm curious, it sounded like from what you said that you were surprised that the police didn't do more or couldn't do more. What has been done since the early investigation until now? You know, is it still active? Are they still actively working on it? Do you have any faith in any of the detectives that are handling the case now?
I mean, I was really hopeful that Jennifer Mitch, she had been featured on the first 48 a couple times, I believe. She was the detective that was over the cold cases and stuff at, when I initiated contact with the Cincinnati Police Department. And she said that they weren't able to come up with anything else. There was no DNA. There wasn't any kind of debris under her nails or anything like that for them to be able to test. Apparently, they weren't able to test for anything that had to do with the assailant's DNA or blood or anything like that, because there wasn't anything present. I don't understand how that's the case, but I mean, that's what they've told me. When I've tried to follow up on that with the new detective that's on it, he barely had any kind of a response whatsoever. It was almost like they felt like I was bothering them, or that it was too much of a burden to do their job. And I had to remind them that the public pays their salary, and that I am part of the public and would like the information about my grandmother. I was told that there was nothing else that they could find or do with her investigation, and a conversation was cut off. I have a thread of information on, you know, in email that if I can dig it up, I can send it to you. But the conversation was really weird, but they gave me like little bits and pieces of stuff, but nothing that was substantial enough to really be able to know a direction to go with it or to ask questions about. But they didn't seem like they really wanted to speak or answer any questions.
It's unfortunate because, you know, I understand the police have other crimes they've got to work on, stuff like that, but I think they should always take, you know, the time to hear from the family and to say, okay, well, we're doing our best, or no new leads or something, give you something without cutting off contact, that kind of thing. It's only natural that you want to know and have an update as to what's going on, and that she hasn't been forgotten.
Right. And well, and the other thing too, is that I am not aware of there being any kind of conversation or questioning or anything like that of ex-Chief Stryker, who was the person that my uncle was snitching to. So I don't know if there would have been any information he could have provided to the investigators or anything like that that might have led to somebody, you know, retaliating against my uncle and what he was doing. And I mean, it's very possible, but I mean, who knows? But I don't know of anybody questioning him too.
Well, it's a very, very cloudy case, it sounds like, and yeah, you know, a couple different possibilities, but nothing clear, no clear direction to go down. I'm wondering how you and your family, how confident you are after so much time's passed. Do you think the case may one day be solved? Do you hold out hope, or do you think that at this point it's not going to be solved?
I mean, I know we all like are hopeful that that'll be the case, but I don't think anybody really expects any resolution, to be honest. You know, and it's really sad that my grandmother's last living sibling, you know, she's 91 right now, 92. And I mean, she's getting up there, and I would love to be able to get some kind of information that's definitive for her before she passes away. I mean, I think that's honestly one of the things that she's holding on for.
Yeah, it's tough to not have answers after so long. Now, and I know that the case has gotten some attention. There's been some podcast episodes about it, things like that.
Yeah.
You've been trying to, you know, make sure her case isn't forgotten. Are there any social media pages or websites, anything like that, where people can learn more about the case or provide tips, anything like that?
Now, I know that the Cincinnati Police Department does have a cold case website that you can go to, like, provide tips anonymously and such, to be able to go the correct direction or, like, give leads or something. But then there's also the Facebook page that I had created as well for my grandmother. But it's called Ernestine Morgan Hurt Cold Case. So if anybody wants to look at that or check it out or anything like that, that's available. So I'm trying to get to the profile, and apparently my internet connection just does not want to cooperate. But yeah, the cold case site for the Cincinnati Police Department. Okay. It's Facebook, or I'm sorry, www.facebook.com/ErnestineMHCC. And then I'm going to see if I can find that webpage for the cold cases. Cause I know that it is here. Cold cases. See if I can find grandma's real quick. All right. Okay, I just found it. The webpage for that is going to be, well, come on, www.ohioattorneygeneral.gov/files/law-enforcement/investigator/cold-case. It's a long address. /homicides/hurt-(2) inside of it.
Okay. And for listeners, we'll put that link in the show notes so that if anyone wants to read more about the case, provide a tip, anything like that, they can just click right on there and find it easily enough. And we'll put any links to any of the social media that we can up there too, so people can learn more about your grandmother's case. You've definitely, you know, been an advocate trying to make sure it's not forgotten. And I hope somehow that despite the passage of time and not a lot of witnesses or other evidence, that you're able to somehow find out who did this and if they can be held accountable. Hopefully that happens for you.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, and like I said, I'm more concerned about getting that answer for my great aunt more so than for anybody else. But I know everyone else in our family is hopeful. We just, after being so long and everything, I don't think anybody really expects it to happen. But if the person is still alive, I mean, I would really hope that they would be willing to confess it at least on their deathbed or something. But I just don't hold out a whole lot of hope for that.
Unfortunately, the passage of time and stuff, it's harder to solve these cases. But, you know, we do see every week there's different old cases being solved. And, you know, so keep the hope. But again, thank you so much for joining us to discuss your grandmother's case with us.
Yes, thank you very much for picking this up.
Thank you once again for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'd like to thank Sonny Landon for writing and research assistance in this episode. We'll be back here soon with an all-new episode of The Murder of My Family, and I hope you'll join me for it. But before you go, remember that every murder victim means something to somebody.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.